This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
The year is 1976. Apple is established and Apple One goes on sale. 1982, Steve Jobs takes over development of Macintosh. 1984 sees the introduction and launch of the Macintosh with a major global advertising campaign, including a commercial shot by Ridley Scott. The Apple Mac has arrived. 1985, Steve Jobs is removed from Apple by the board. He goes on to take over Pixar and establish Next. 1991, the PowerBook makes its debut, weighing a mere 7.5 kilos. 96, Apple acquire Pixar and Next, and Steve Jobs returns as advisor. 1997, Steve Jobs becomes chairman. Apple Online Store is launched. 1998, design led the way and we saw the beginnings of impeccable looks along with cool technology. 2001, the Apple retail store is launched and the iPod arrives. 2003, an iTunes is born, offering music downloads for 99 cents per track. By 2008, there are over 5 billion downloads. Between 2003-2006, the share price has increased tenfold. 2007, a phone as we had never known before. We meet the iPhone. In 2008, the App Store arrives, with apps available for our iPhone and iPod Touch. The arrival of apps brought great changes to our lives, and within 1 month, 60 million apps were sold. It's 2010, and then along came the iPad, a large, slim, portable screen we could take anywhere, enabling us to manage and edit our consumption of content. August 24, 2011, Steve Jobs resigns as CEO of Apple. October 6th, Apple announces that Steve Jobs has died. The news is out immediately. We received it as Twitter updates. It hit our social media services. Our RSS feeds were sending it through. We shared it with friends on Facebook, watched visual content on YouTube. We went into our preferred media apps to get as much as we could absorb about this man, and there was a lot to get. We edited our news the way we chose. So by the time our local major newspapers were leading with the loss of Steve Jobs as front page news, for most of us, it was already yesterday's news. Good afternoon. I welcome you all here today. I'm Lowen Steele. I'm from Kojo. Proud to be here and welcome to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas and today's session, The Future of Media. Is it all online? I think you're in for a great discussion today. I've been asked to do just a little bit of housekeeping before we start, so please make sure your mobile phones are off or at least on silent. And we welcome you to Twitter whilst you're in here. Our hashtag is, you're welcome to tweet at Ideas Adelaide, and our hashtag is AFOI. Our speakers today will carry on quite a diverse conversation, and our chair is Luke Stegman. And I have a bio here to read to you on Luke. Luke is born and raised in the eastern states of Australia and later a graduate of the universities of Adelaide and Sydney. Luke Stegman has worked extensively in education, academia, media, research journalism, and media business management. He has lived and worked in both Asia and Europe for many years and returned to Australia in 2008 to take up the position of general manager for the publishing division of the Global Intertrade Group of Companies. In his day-to-day role, he conducts managerial and editorial oversight across a range of publications, including the Adelaide Review and the Melbourne Review.
Thanks very much, Lauren. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks very much for coming along on this beautiful afternoon. I think there's a topic like this is so broad and there's so many different things that we could talk about. So I guess the best thing is let's get into it and just cover as much ground as we can. Looking at the the overall theme for this year's Festival of Ideas, planning for uncertainty. There's no doubt, of course, that we live in very, very uncertain times. And yet, if we look back over the last two decades, probably since the sort of the 80s or the late 80s, certainly through the 90s and the noughties, we lived through a time when the mantra was all about change. It was constant change. Change was good, change was inevitable. The only thing that you knew about tomorrow was that there would be change. There's been so much change which is associated, has been associated with those sort of neoliberal political and economic developments in our society over the last two decades. And yet, at the end of all that, we've reached a period now, probably post-GFC, where we're in a time of extreme uncertainty. Certainly, we live in a time of resource uncertainty, climate uncertainty, political uncertainty, and I'm not referring to the question of Julia Gillard, Tony Abbott, and so on and so forth, but more to the geopolitical uncertainty, Australia's role in the Asian century, and how we align ourselves between China and the United States and so on, and so much social uncertainty as well. And within all this, the context in which all this is occurring is a society in which we are all more connected than ever before. Lern was just referring now to how news events break to us immediately. There's no lag whatsoever between an occurrence now knowing about it. And so how do we find our way in terms of the media that we consume and the media that many of us produce as well? Now, the other night, the opening session here, Philip Adams asked a question of one of the panellists, and it was, how to explain the fact that in the United States, which was his example, a country which has such a tremendous tradition of scientific research and discovery, yet at the same time, there were so many people, and an increasing number of people, who have, if you like, Old Testament worldviews, denouncing Charles Darwin and everything that's sort of occurred in science ever since. And I think, while it's true that a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing, I think it's also true that an overload of knowledge and an overload of information can be a terrifying thing. And I think a lot of people are retreating to more certain times, things of greater surety. So where do we sort of fit with that within the media? I think what we'll start off, the way we'll start the session now is I'll ask each of us to give a quick yes, no, with a couple of sentences if you like, to the question, the future of media, is it all online? And then after that, we'll speak about the different roles that we play. I will talk about what I've particularly over the last 6 months, which has been the launching of a print publication in Melbourne, in an environment where a lot of people are asking, why on earth are you, investing in a new print publication in this digital age? Sandra will talk about where the national broadcaster fits in all of this, and Andrew will talk about initially about his the website that he's been intimately involved with, theconversation.edu.au, which is a really quite revolutionary type of website, I'm sure. So, Andrew, the future of media, is it all online? Briefly, yes or no?
Maybe. Look, I've spent most of my life running newspapers with websites, obviously, and now I run just an online site. And I have to say it's incredibly liberating, mm-hmm. not having to worry about the production side of newspapers, mm-hmm. which you'll know about, which is the printing and the delivery, and printing presses sometimes go wrong, the trucks sometimes go wrong, and then people don't get their papers first thing in the morning, and then you get phone calls. And I just love the fact that all my focus is on ideas, yeah. and then we press a button and it goes out. Mm-hmm. So I like that. But look, I think the question is slightly contorted for this reason. I'm actually interested in content and journalism. Mm-hmm. I'm less interested in the delivery platform. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, where is the journalism and content of the future, particularly quality end, mm-hmm. going to come from, the trusted information of the future? That's all I'm concerned about. Whether it goes out on an iPad or a magazine or a newspaper or any other delivery mechanism, to me, is irrelevant, mm-hmm. frankly. I just want to know, how can we have a public conversation mm-hmm. around big ideas with an authoritative and credible approach towards that information? Because that's what, if you like, a modern democracy requires. Mm-hmm. And I'm very concerned about the imploding business models, particularly of newspapers, which, by the way, for 150 years have had a great run. Mm-hmm. They've had basically monopolies. And by the way, here in Adelaide, you just have one paper, and I worry about you all. But that is coming to an end. And the question is if the advertising model, which has really supported journalism all these years, is coming to an end, what next? Mm-hmm. And I'll just make one last point, which is the analogy I use right now is tectonic plates moving between, as it were, the old newspaper print days and the new digital and whatever platforms. And when tectonic plates move, you get an earthquake. And in that earthquake, you get disasters. Sometimes houses fall down. Sometimes people are damaged in the process. And I think that's what's happening with the media right now. There are casualties. And by the way, we're talking about real casualties. In the US, hundreds of papers have closed. Quite a few in the UK as well, not so many here. So as these move, we're going to get a new world order of information. And that's the really interesting bit to me. So I'm actually very optimistic that there are going to be some wonderful new sort of journalism enterprises, new ways of... I mean, you know, the iPad is only... It's only been with us for about 18 months. You know, these are brand new technologies. I don't quite know. I can't be certain about the future, but I'm quite optimistic. My key concern is the business model. How are we going to fund quality journalism?
Thanks. And there's a lot of points that I'll follow up on there in a moment. But I certainly agree. I'm very, very optimistic about the future. Absolutely. There's all sorts of initiatives out there at the moment, which, as you say, the decline of newspapers has, in a sense, opened up the playing field for some very, very interesting new initiatives, which we'll talk about in a moment. Sandra, is it all online? Yes or no?
No. It's not all online, but eventually a component of it all will be online, if it is not already. I think that the research is certainly showing that people are wanting it all. You know, and for different reasons. You know, whether it's the iPad or whether it's the mobile, you know, smartphone, or whether it's the traditional free-to-air television, whether it's newspapers, it's print, whether it's magazine. We're not giving up the research. The PwC have just released. In fact, I was lucky enough to go to a briefing this week, where they talked about the growing pie, and that everyone is actually. People are watching television free-to-air more than they have in the past. Mm-hmm. People are newspapers are even going up in terms of their eyeballs. But the issue is that people want it everywhere. They want to have their newspapers online on their iPad or on their smartphone, as well as in the print. Or with television, the ABC, we have News 24, for instance, which is streamed so that you can watch it on your computer, your iPad, your smartphone, as well as in the traditional, you know, at home with your family watching the big screen, you know, or the huge screen as a, you know. So people, the research that PricewaterhouseCoopers, or PwC as they're now known, have come up with is basically showing that still by the year 2015, the majority of us, in fact, 86% of us, will still be getting most of our media through traditional sources, and only 16% through purely online. So we've still got a long way to go, and part of that, I think, is also the NBN rollout once we get faster broadband speeds. And I mean, I go out to the regional areas quite a lot, and the feedback I get is how slow the broadband speeds are. We can't watch your iView, we can't watch your, you know, News 24 on our laptops because we just don't have the band speed. But the NBN will be a game changer in that. Having said that, there's certain huge tracts of land in Australia which aren't getting the NBN. In South Australia, I know parts of the Eyre Peninsula, Woodna, all through there, not getting the NBN. So, you know, that there's still going to be some inequities in terms of how we access our media, and there's going to be, you know, many, many platforms.
Right, look, I think one of the so-called most endangered platforms is that of good old print. But I think when people talk about the print being in danger, they're really referring to newspapers because although magazine circulations to an extent are down, but some of them are up. So within that context, I'll just describe very briefly experiences over the last 6 months. Most of you, I would hope, most of you would know the publication The Adelaide Review, as it's a sponsor of this festival, amongst other things. But for some time, we'd considered that that model of publication, which is actually unique in the media landscape in Australia, there is no other publication quite like it in Sydney or Brisbane or Melbourne. We always considered that type of publication would really, really work well in Melbourne. And we looked very, very closely at the Melbourne market, and we realised that there wasn't anything exactly like that. Had there been, we wouldn't be wasting our time going over there and launching a publication like the Melbourne Review. So seeing that there really was a gap in the market, and it's the publication which I'm absolutely proud to say launches tomorrow in Melbourne. It's been a uphill battle, but it's there and it's looking fantastic. So I think the publication which is closest to it in the Australian media landscape would be the Australians, the Weekend Australians Review magazine, which I think is an absolutely fantastic magazine with superb journalists, superb coverage, and great writers. It's not exactly like any of the Age's weekend supplements. It's not like any of the other life and style type magazines. It doesn't have that evident political bent that perhaps magazines like The Monthly or Overland or Quadrant and so on have. It's not a specifically literary magazine either, like Mianjin or Island or Southerly or Wet Ink, Kill Your Darlings or a host of others. So there was a space there for a publication which covers a broad range of topics but provides intelligent writing. Now, Andrew said before he doesn't really worry about the platform. What's important is the content, and I couldn't agree more, because with both the Adelaide Review and certainly with the Melbourne Review now, what really matters to us is the quality of the writing. And therefore, one of the first things is to look beyond your traditional pool of journalists. So most of the people who write for us are not journalists. They're people who are industry professionals, whether it be a winemaker, an architect, a designer, a poet, a philosopher, an academic, whoever it might be. But they're not your traditionally understood journalists. There's an enormous number of highly educated, highly literate, highly skilled writers in Australia nowadays. Probably always have been. And an awful lot of them are not journalists. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't have a place in which they can write. Now, print still has a certain prestige value to it. I was at an event not long ago. In fact, it was a screening of a documentary film called Page One, A Year in the Life of the New York Times, looking at the transition from print to digital in the New York Times, and the casualties that occurred along the way. And when Andrew says about casualties, and they are real casualties, and people have lost their jobs, no doubt about it. But excuse me, I just have a drink. With the Page One with the New York Times, after that there was a bit of a chat session, and someone commented there that people who write, not necessarily fiction writers, but just, you know, professional writers, freelance writers, would prefer to see their piece in print and 1,000 people read it than it to be online and 50,000 people read it. Now, you may not agree with that, but there's something about that solidity of being in print. So there are an enormous number of voices in Australia that have a lot of great things to say. So in a sense, almost what we're doing is subverting the previous model, which is where everybody wanted to talk about things, so they create a blog. And they go online, they have a blog. But a blog, again, with all due respect, but a blog is essentially someone with a computer and an opinion. Right? And there's not really that much difference between someone who has a couple of glasses of beer and an opinion. Right? And blogs proliferated extraordinarily about 10 years ago, and a lot of them were as boring as talking to someone down the pub when they've had a couple of drinks. So, nevertheless, out of that, there are some really, really fine people who've emerged as fantastic bloggers. So one of the things that we do is try to find those people and bring them back into print and give them that print platform. Now, a lot of people have said to us, you know, you must be crazy launching a new print publication. But the thing that has affected, and Andrew would know more about this than I do, but the thing that really has affected the daily papers, the loss of the so-called rivers of gold, all the classified advertising and so on. But we were never in that market in the first place. Our publications, such as the Adelaide Review, the Melbourne Review, we don't do real estate, we don't do classifieds, we've never been in that market. With print publications, there's a real future if the publication is niche, and it's very high quality, and the business model that runs it is lean and mean. So it's not just the loss of the rivers of gold that have affected, you know, Fairfax and News Limited, these major publications, but it's also that with the transition in media, these places found themselves massively overstaffed. And that's where also the losses occurred and where a lot of the casualties took place. So all in all, just summing up, I would say I'm very, very confident and very, very pleased about the future of print. But summing it up, you have to be niche, not so niche that no one reads you, of course, but you've got to be niche, you've got to concentrate on quality, and the other thing is, we publish monthly publications, so we couldn't be in that game of doing daily or even weekly, because, as Andrew said, all the things that can go wrong in terms of your, you know, your production and your printing, and the enormous costs associated with all that as well. So the extent that, you minimise that, you can still put out really high-quality print publications, find an enormous range of interesting voices to speak in that, and you've got a product which advertisers like, which the public hopefully love to read. So from that point of view, you know, the last 6 months' work launching the Melbourne Review has been, no doubt it hasn't been easy, but you know, the end result is that there's a fantastic product, and let's hope that it you know, that it finds its place and settles into the Melbourne media landscape the way the Adelaide Review has done over here for many, many years. Andrew, let's go over to you. Tell us about the conversation then.
Right. Can I just make a bit of a confession to everyone? I was listening to Julian Burnside. Did anybody go to that out of interest? And I listened to all the questions, and I suddenly looked at my watch, and it was about 5 to 2. So I just ran from there to here in 5 minutes. So I'm suffering a bit here. Has anybody seen the conversation?
Yep.
A few people. Right. We launched it 6 months ago. I'm a great believer in diversity, and I'm just delighted, by the way, Luke, that you're launching into Melbourne as well as here in Adelaide. But we're very different to what you're doing. For a bunch of reasons. One is that we are a not-for-profit educational trust, so nobody owns us. We don't have a rich owner. We don't have a bunch of owners. It's just owned by a trust as a charity registered with the ATO. So there are no shares. I don't own any shares. I just get paid. The second thing is that we're slightly different to your model as well, Luke, in that we actually only use experts. Mm. And we use professional journalists. And the way it works is that I was invited by the Vice Chancellor at Melbourne University, Glyn Davis, to go and look at how the university was communicating with the public. But also at the back of my head, I had the worry, which I outlined earlier on, which is where will the quality, trusted, credible, authoritative content of the future come from? And as I walked around the university, it occurred to me that actually there were some of the smartest people I'd ever met there. The problem was that they were disengaged with the public discourse. They spoke in sometimes a language which was academic rather than plain English. They sometimes had difficulty formulating articles, and they took too long, frankly. So we hired editors. There are 15 of us. We work with experts in their field, academics and researchers. And we get them to, we actually help them translate, and we have programs, by the way, that do that. We can't do it all manually, but we edit as well to make sure that they're connected into the debate, that we know about the research that's going on. And by the way, there's an enormous amount of fantastic research going on in all the universities. Yesterday I was at Flinders, and they're just inventing a new sort of glasses that actually help with jet lag, something I'm actually suffering from, having just got back from the UK. This wonderful research going on, a lot of it to be commercialized. The second thing is that on any of the complex current affairs issues, topical issues out there, be it population issues, refugees, which is why I wanted to hear Julian, climate change issues, etc., on virtually everything, there is somebody at a university in Australia, and don't forget there are 39, there are 55,000 full-time academics. There is an expert out there who can actually give you a really in-depth view of something. And this is the last bit, which is comes from an independent source of information. So again, we do a couple of things to try and rebuild trust with our readers. The first thing is ownership. I've touched on that. We're not part of a political party or part of a commercial interest or part of a rich man's hobby or anything like that, which is behind a lot of publishing. The second issue is that we have a disclosure statement where every academic has to disclose who's funding them. And that tries to avoid the issue of conflict. And quite often, in fact, a lot of the time in Australia, people hide their commercial or political or other allegiances. So disclosure is terribly important. We also have a charter, which is open there on community standards. We also believe in what's called open access publishing. We actually say on our site, steal our stuff. It's published under something called Creative Commons. We want to disseminate knowledge as widely as possible. This knowledge that sits within the universities belongs to us all. And what our job as professional editors is to try and mine it, to edit it, get it out in a timely way so it engages there and then with what's in the news and what the topical issues are. So this is part of trying to rebuild it. We started 6 months ago, so literally we've just passed our 6 months. During that time, we've exceeded our targets by about four times. We've had 3.5 million article views, just coming up to that. We're attracting, in terms of unique visitors, over 250,000 a month, and it's growing at a sort of phenomenal rate. And what does that tell me? Does that say that we've done something particularly new or different? Perhaps. What it also tells me is there's a yearning and a requirement out there for the kind of service that we're providing. And by the way, the website is only one thing we do. We provide copy to The Drum, mm-hmm. We provide and to ABC, we provide copy to SBS, we provide it, we're in the middle of doing a deal with Fairfax, we provided a whole bunch of different outlets. So the website is just one place where we disseminate, and the idea is just to push this knowledge and this wealth of wisdom and information out to the broader public, but to do so with certain very distinct protocols, which is to help rebuild trust in content.
Thanks. I'll come to you in just a second, Sandra, but just I wanted to clarify there, Andrew. It's your emphasis once again on expertise and quality is something which absolutely holds true for everything we do as well. And by the way, I talked about creating this new print publication in Melbourne, but nevertheless, as in is inevitable nowadays, you have to also have a website, which is very, very important, and of course all that social media engagement as well. So it's not that we're ignoring the online element. One final thing, very, very briefly, I just wanted to let you know that there has been a lot of goodwill towards us simply for the fact that we are neither News Limited nor Fairfax.
Yeah.
There's a real sense of, oh, thank goodness, someone else. You talked about
Absolutely.
Diversity before.
Yeah. No, congratulate you on
yes,
that.
Yes. Sandra, in the midst of all this, the national broadcaster.
Well, and there's SBS and there's NITV as well. And I think the challenge for us is to move this huge ship of national broadcaster into a world that does want wants us on all the platforms that are available. So we need to be able to be in the digital space in terms of digital television and our multi-channels, so ABC1, ABC2, the Children's Channel, News24. We need to do what we traditionally do, Radio National, ABC Classic FM, Triple J, local radio, which has got 60 microphones open across the country, but also have that streamed so you can, listen to radio on your phone, you can on your website. Same with television, you can iView. We were the first in Australia to come up with a system whereby you can, if you missed spics and specs, you can watch it the next day on iView on the computer. So we've got to be in all that space. And we do all of that, as well as a huge website that we have. Andrew mentions The Drum. We're moving into the print area too in terms of online and not without some controversy as well. Someone might like to ask about, but we have moved into a whole range of areas, and we do that in less than the budget of Channel 9. Everything that we do, that's not to say we're not well funded, and we need to be efficient, and we're doing a whole range of things behind the scenes now to actually make us much more efficient, and that some of that too is not without controversy, without some redundancies and what have you. But we're repositioning ourselves to be still relevant in this digital era, and a lot of that is online, but not all of it. As I mentioned before, the PwC research, we still, the majority of our viewers and listeners and are still accessing us in the traditional ways, not online, but we have to be online. We also have to use the Twitter and Facebook and look at our marketing. We also have to be on Foxtel and, you know, Austar as well. We have to be on the pay channels as well to be able to get out to everyone that we want to get out to. But in terms of why even have national broadcasters, when we talk about the plurality of voices out there, why do we need the ABC? Why do we need SBS? Why do we need NITV, who are looking at merging with SBS at the moment? But it is about I think the same reasons that we've had the ABC forever, really, or since 1924, and it is for Australian voices. And it is for the independent, non-commercial voice. There's a whole, it is about investing in areas like Radio National, where the commercial viability of doing a lot of the content that we make for Radio National, a lot of that now is going online. And we're, of course, the Radio National, we've got a huge presence online, but the national broadcasters are there, particularly, and I think our big strength, and it's always been our political strength as well, as in our regional areas where there is contraction, when there is networking more and more, we are actually increasing our resources in our regional areas. We've got the ABC Open reporters, which are helping with digital literacy in these communities to help them to understand how they can make their own content for not just putting on our website, but putting on a commercial website if they so wish. So it is about maintaining our relevance and our reason for being and justifying that and, having that conversation and,
Sandra, one of the hallmarks of the media, the digital media that we're talking about here, is this explosion of participants. Right? And, the ABC opens up its websites to comment as much as any other site. What are you doing to maintain, I guess, those questions which Andrew mentioned before about authority, integrity and independence, when suddenly there are so many more voices coming in to what the ABC sites are?
And that forms new policies as well within the ABC as to how we manage that and how we clearly mark what is content, that user-generated content that's coming in that actually hasn't necessarily been through a filter and hasn't necessarily been moderated, although a lot of the stuff is moderated. There are some areas where it's not. And we've got to clearly mark that out, that is legitimate. I mean, it's like talkback radio. I mean, we get hammered, from time to time during an emergency because we're putting calls to air that might not be necessarily. We haven't, checked everything they've said for accuracy, or back through the Country Fire Service or what have you. But we still think, well, we've got to make some judgments about putting those calls to air. I mean, that's the original user-generated content, in a sense, talkback radio. But it's important to have those voices but we also have to acknowledge, you give weight to certain voices over others. An expert from the Country Fire Service, CFS, would have, their view, obviously, with the research or the access to information they have, might be, you'd weight that more than, Doris calling in from, Mount Barker, saying what she's saying. Having
Hello,
said that, you've got to take a notice of Doris.
Look, can I just jump in for a second? Because I understand why you need to talk about efficiencies at the ABC, but that's very much management speak. I actually think the opposite. I think the ABC is underfunded, badly underfunded.
Well, thank you, Andrea.
I'm really tired of this management speak about we need to be more efficient. Of course we all need to be, but quite often efficiency means let's cut costs. I mean, I actually am delighted you did the slap, I think it was a fantastic piece of drama, obviously just the first episode's out. But that to me is an example of a book written in Melbourne which represents Australian, modern Australian life, all sorts of moral dilemmas in there, and Some of the acting, I think, is a variable quality. But nonetheless, I applaud the ABC doing that. Mm. I want to see you investing in more Australian documentaries, more Australian drama, and less rebadging the BBC. Because frankly, quite often, it's just the BBC with an A at the front of it. Mm. And the real issue here, and I don't know if everybody in the audience follows this, but the real issue is that Rupert Murdoch's dad, Keith, was an opponent of the ABC and always has been an opponent. It's in the Murdoch family DNA. And James in the UK has spoken out against the BBC, and the new government that came in, the Tory government in the UK, promised, I think it was part of almost a pact, if Murdoch papers supported them, they would sort out the BBC. And sure enough, they locked immediately 10% off the budget, which led to efficiencies, you know. What it's about is it's a dislike of the ABC and BBC competing in a space where essentially they have to raise advertising dollars to make the way. Now, there is an argument, Luke, and I think you were touching on it earlier, just about, you know, particularly, I think you're making reference to the Drum website, which has been quite controversial because it's seen as competing with the likes of The Punch and National Times and other providers. The issue really is one of market failure, and market failure is where I don't think you have sufficient diversity of voices. And I think it's really great that the ABC is there, and I back the ABC. As I said, I'd like it to see it doing more and better. But nonetheless, I think it's great, particularly, you know, for those of you who live here in Adelaide in South Australia, you know, just to have the advertiser, which is fair enough, but just to have the advertiser would be a real shame. The fact is you've also got the ABC voice there and, of course, your websites. And increasingly, if you live here in Adelaide, you can, of course, read The Age online and, you know, the New York Times or whatever else. So I think things are changing. I don't know where it's all going to end up. But the point I just wanted to say to you is, please, don't be defensive. Mm. Be more optimistic. Let's grow
I'd like to answer that. I think you're right. I think, you know, it is a funding issue. But I also think that it's taxpayers' money and we need to be using that money as efficiently as we can. I know it might be management speak, but the issue is, I mean, I was in a production review, the only person outside Sydney, actually, to be on the ABC production review, looking at how we could actually make some savings internally to put into content like drama, to put into documentaries, to make a whole new News 24 channel, which we weren't funded for. And we did that by a whole range of ways. I won't go into everything, but things like desktop editing, you know, our journalists having to be, you know, multi-skilled, putting our news to air now not with eight people but with two people, those sorts of things where we can actually then put money back in to making that content, which I agree with you is the most important thing we do. We've got to make, you know, more and more of that really rich content that does in this. With all the voices, a lot of them on the internet are foreign voices, and we need actually to be able to have that Australian content very strong.
Absolutely, and certainly I agree with Andrew that the slap is off to a great start. But you know, our publishing group is entirely self-funded. I mean, you know, we talk about efficiencies. We work with a month-by-month reality that there's a bottom line that has to be achieved, and if it's not, well then, you know, publications don't go any further. It's as simple as that. Mm. So within those constraints, you try at the same time. Those constraints will always temper your idealism, but within those constraints, you still try to be as creative and as adaptive and as serious and as rigorous as you possibly can be. Certainly. Mm. Look, we'll turn it in a couple of minutes. We'll just turn it over to the audience. I'm sure there's a couple of questions, and you know the hour goes so fast. I guess. Sandra, let's go to you then, sort of as a final comment before we go to the questions. What media exists in the future that's not online then, or digital in some way? Is it just, you know, little publications like some of the ones that we produce and the odd Sam is Dat here and there, or...?
No, I think, well, radio, for instance, radio is...
But radio, I mean, it's all transitioning over to digital as well.
Well, there's digital radio in the cities. The federal government certainly is not talking about rolling out digital radio to the regions at this particular time. So the analog AM and FM is still, you know, very much part of the landscape. And I think from the research I've read, it's going to be for the next 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. Television. Well, we have gone digital, but it's not all online. Streaming digital television all online is, mm-hmm. takes a huge bandwidth and costs a huge amount of money. And so I think that in terms of traditional media of free-to-air television, there's still going to be a place for the transmitter towers and for the for television being... I mean, people do... They've got home theatres now. They want, you know, their television to come through, you know, in HD and you know, at a high quality, as well as on your smartphone, you know. So, you know, in terms of print, I still think there will be, you know, there's certainly a life for print.
Can I just jump in on print? Because I'm part of a media consultancy that does a lot of work around print, particularly towards convergence, by the way. So it's not just print, that's just one delivery platform. But if you take in Australia, the companies Fairfax, News Limited, etc., I think they would have probably gone bust if it wasn't for the fact they've got print outlets. So for every dollar that you make in print, you can probably make the equivalent of about 2 or 3 cents. That's the advertising ratio. The dollars that you can make on print are so much larger. So really, it's the newspapers that have actually been, you know, the healthiest part, the most robust part of those portfolios. And I still think, and I'm glad you agree with me, there is still a future for print. I think a lot of print products need to be rethought. And by the way, when we talk about a crisis in print, I went to a conference in India, and there they said, crisis, what crisis? Mm, yep. The Times of India is actually putting on sort of 10-20% a year, mm. because there are 300 million English-speaking middle class who are just gobbling up the Times of India. They're now regionally printing it everywhere. And the same thing is true in a number of other developing markets. So it's really in the more mature markets is a bit of a problem. But I still think there will be a place for slightly different products. Yes. But I still think there will be a future in print. And my last point is, and I think you alluded to this as well, that readers increasingly want what I call martini media, which is, I don't know if you know the jingle, but anywhere, any place, any time. And that's where they want their media. It could be in a paper in the morning, reading it on their smartphone, travelling to work if you're in a tram or train, and then reading it on screen when you get there, and then reversing to TV at night and so on and so forth. So it's just content. But my issue, as I said right at the outset, is how are we going to safeguard trusted, credible, quality content of the future, which is a linchpin of a modern democracy.
Indeed, indeed. Well, it's great. All three of us are very much in agreement that there's a future for print. Anyway, we do have two microphones down there. We've got probably about 15 minutes left. So if anyone would like to step up and ask a question, either to all of us or to any one of us, please feel free.
I think they're leaving.
Yeah, I know. I thought, oh, here's two people, but then they've just gone out to the exit. We've got about 15 minutes or so.
Thank you, Gwendolyn, for some very enlightening thoughts. Quick story and a question. Regional newspapers in regional areas where rural press have about 90% of, or 80%, whatever it is, of all newspapers. One of the things I'd like to see is that the more newspapers generated out in regional areas, so how do you do that? In Roxby Downs, 2003 started their own community newspaper. With its competition with the Rural Press, and has outpointed it in every area. In that town, the community owned the newspaper, radio station, the information service online, and the notice boards. So the community owns all of its own media and runs it. I think we need to look into different ways of creating that media in regional areas and getting the getting the local voice out there more than, in this case, a paper that's printed in Port Augusta that has hardly any contact with the town. But so that's something I think is an opportunity to look how to do it differently and how they got funded. It's all its profits go back into the community for all those areas. But here's the question. We're talking about journalism and the quality of journalism. My colleague, who now is editor for the paper, spent 40-odd years in regional print. He's saying that the students coming out of I can speak only for South Australia, but coming out of our journalism courses here, that they have to retrain them. They're actually not ready, really, to go into the marketplace. And do we, so to this quality of journalism? Do we need to look right back to what's happening for them as students?
Not only
in what they write, but also in their ethics and being, not saying ethics are bad, but being trained and built up as to what it really is.
Ray, what is actually the problem then? In what respect do they need to be retrained?
Well, all around abilities to go out and write quality stories, mm-hmm. and be able to work across all in a country newspaper in all the areas. We're just saying they're not trained well enough. We've got to work more of them. And in fact, there is a course for regional journalism, I believe, as well. So the thing is to keep the standard up, and not only just for regional, but broader, where does the problem start to keep the standard up?
Well, I guess in terms of responding regionally, Sandra, you'd be the best person to.
Well, you know, I think it goes to the question of education and quality education, which then goes through to, the quality that we get of our media as well as of our audience and what they want. You know, whether they want, very shallow media, or whether they actually want some analysis and they want deeper, content. In terms of media training, I actually sit on the Adelaide University Media Degree Board and also the Uni of SA, the Journalism Degree Board, Consultative Board. I think the courses have a big practical element now in terms of the ABC, but also in other media. There's a solid internship program where they actually are expected to go and work in the real world. Having said that, there's a really good place for theory and for liberal arts and knowledge and just, even the classics, to actually just have good, solid grounding in education. I think it's really important. From the ABC's perspective, seeing the graduates, I mean, we see some outstanding graduates that come through, and we don't, our cadetship program has actually unfortunately shrunk over the years, but we still have a cadetship program where we do take straight out of the journalism colleges. So, I'm obviously you've got an experience, but that's my experience.
Thank you.
Thanks. We've got a few more people lining up, so let's move on to the next question.
Thanks for your talk. My question, I suppose, is particularly for Andrew, but I'm sure you all have an opinion. I'm wondering specifically about daily newspapers, the ones that have still managed to survive. I've noticed maybe it's just me, but an increase in syndicated articles, particularly foreign affairs. And is that, I'm sure it is a conscious decision, but how have newspapers changed their editorial policy so that they can compete with blogs and Twitter and all of these new medias mm-hmm. that have sprung up?
Thanks. I started off as a reporter, junior editor, and worked my way up. And when I got to the very top of the pile, and by that I mean as an editor, I suddenly realized that these are actually businesses. That's really what they are. They could be producing anything. And increasingly now, they're run by businessmen who move from, one minute they're running, a manufacturing company, or they're doing some other field, but they're just successful at managing, and they move in to manage your organization. And most of these businesses need to return profits to their shareholders. And these profits need to be in the region of 15 to 20 to 25%. Now, the Age, when I was there, was returning anything from 25 to 30%. And when it actually started to come down, which, by the way, is an obscenely large amount of money, companies like Qantas returning sort of 3 or 4%, when they started to come down, what they immediately did, and sorry for the lecture about the business thing, is they thought, okay, we need to take costs out, okay? So taking costs out meant, why do we need to do that when we could just get it for free almost through a syndicated service? And by free, you pay a small amount, then you just fill up your columns with stuff from all over the place. So that becomes cheap journalism. You then get rid of specialists within the newsroom, and you move towards generalists, because the specialists tend to be more senior and more higher paid. So you tend to get more and more in. Now, the previous speaker talked about rural press. The guy who took over Fairfax was from rural press, and he said to me, look, in future, when you recruit, you're best to recruit school leavers because they're the cheapest. And that was it. So he was telling me at the age that I should start hiring school leavers rather than trained journalists or people who've just come out of a journalism course or whatever. So that's the driver. And the driver is that we need to retain profits. So in a market that's collapsing somewhat, the successful manager takes out his costs faster than the revenues come down. So I don't know, I know that's a very businessy answer towards it, but frankly, that's what's happening. And there's another disease which is called churnalism, which is where you get a press release and you just rewrite it. There was a recent survey by UTS University in Sydney, which found that 70% of all the content in all newspapers, they just looked at newspapers, came from press releases. So this wasn't anything that was actually being investigated or reported by the own reporters and journalists on the papers. It was just actually taking in press releases and quite often not even rewriting them. So that's the kind of disease that's going on within newspapers. And if that carries on, are we surprised that a lot of readers look at these papers and say, do you know what, they're actually not that good? And, you know, it's the same content, it's called commoditized content, that's just across lots of different platforms. And what's happening, and again, I refer to the previous speaker, he's actually doing something different, you know, in his local community. And that's why people are buying into it. It's not press releases. It's not AAP wire or whatever else coming in. And to me, that's, you know, in a sense, I think, Luke, that's where the new forms of content are going to come, which is where people are going to come up with something different to what's available more widely.
Can I just ask you a question there, Andrew? Thanks very much. I mean, it seemed to me the immediate answer to the question that you asked was that the increased amount of syndication is obviously an effect of imposed efficiencies that we were talking about before. But, Andrew, you talked there very briefly about your career path, and when you got right to the top, you realised, for want of a better term, the commercial realities. My question would be, why did you not know that beforehand? Did you not operate in that sphere on the way up, as it were? Did you not learn those things?
Well, look, when you have, you know, I mean, I saw it almost, this sounds pompous, almost as like a calling to go into journalism. You know, I just really like the idea of the job of a journalist, which is to hold those in power to account, to, you know, to make those powerful, you know, realize that you know, what they do matters, that, you know, that business is conducted ethically and all those kind of things. I mean, that's what really drove me, more of a purist approach towards it. And yes, I was aware that newspapers were businesses, but we were cushioned for a long time by the fact that newspapers just made, as you said earlier,
profitable.
Rivers of gold. Rivers, you know, gold. Just ran in, you didn't have to worry about it. Somebody said to me, you open the front door of the Age on a Monday morning, the money just poured in, you know. So, you know, and then when things got tighter, you realised that actually, you know, fundamentally, these are businesses. And in businesses, and again, sorry for this, you know, very, very sort of plain speaking approach towards it, but these businesses are run by people who are bonused, and the bonuses come in every 6 months, whether they actually achieve their targets in terms of profits. And that's really what they're interested in, not the content, not the quality. At the Age, at senior management levels, nobody ever talked about the quality of the Age or Sydney Morning Herald. It was just about how much money they were making. And that fundamentally is what they're about.
Yes, please.
I was wondering if anyone on the panel wanted to comment on the environmental sustainability of print media.
Well, let me just say immediately that I have been told that essentially... Look, our group does not print an awful amount when you compare it to a News Limited or a Fairfax. Yeah? We do 30,000 Adelaide reviews. We do 12,000 Rip It Up magazine here in Adelaide each week. We're doing 70,000 Melbourne review each month and so on. So the numbers are pretty small. But we've certainly got a very specific direction to source as green, for want of a better word, paper as possible. However... high-quality recycled paper tends to be very, very expensive in Australia. Very often, we come back again to running a business. The cheapest option is not to go for the highest percentage of recycled content in the paper. I don't know if you have any comment on that, Andrew, from your time in newspapers, but often going for the greenest option is the most expensive one. So then you balance that with all the other things that you're trying to balance to see how the number stacks up at the end of the month. And sometimes there's pressure to, you know... not print on as eco-friendly paper as perhaps you might like to?
So look, I mean, I'm out of that, so I'm quite pleased. But look, the biggest producer of paper in the world, or one of the biggest, is Norway, and they literally harvest forests. Mm. You know, they plant them, and they take 15 to 20 years until they mature, and then they cut them down and turn them into wood pulp, into wood chip. These are not old-growth forests. These are just straightforward commercial forests. It's a business. It employs a lot of people in Norway, and that's really their business. And wherever possible, I think all newspaper owners are trying to do the right thing, and that is use as much recycled paper as possible. But as I say, I'm thankfully no longer having to defend that one.
We're going to have to wrap it up now, but perhaps there's just time for a final comment. Sandra, would you like to...
I think there's somebody, Luke, about to jump up.
Oh, sorry. Yes, we can take... Yeah. Off. Yes, quickly. Yes,
you've just literally been waiting.
We won't make any final comments. Please, have you?
Sorry. No, yeah. I just wanted to ask, given that online media is so broad and kind of taking over everything because it's just coming from everywhere and you can't control it, with print, are you trying to assimilate or differentiate? Like, are you trying to jump on that bandwagon of lots of people, lots of participation, or are you trying to be the voice of authority and moving away from entertainment pieces and being like, okay, we're going to just be news? I mean, I read the Advertiser today and there was a story about a puppy was on YouTube.
But not
cute, but relevant?
But there's a lot of stuff which is neither news nor entertainment. I mean, there's a vast expanse in between those two, which tends to be the ground that we occupy, because we're not operating on a 24/7 news cycle. Right? And I said before, we don't do real estates, we don't do classifieds, we don't do celebrities either. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a vast amount of middle ground there, which there's a lot of intelligent... not just commentary, but coverage to be done.
So differentiation as opposed to...
Oh, very much so. I wouldn't like to think we're trying to jump on any bandwagon. But certainly there's a lot of synergy between our print publications and the online version. Well, they're not exactly online versions. They are a digital development from what exists in print.
My quick point on that is that, as I said, I think we're in a very fluid situation right now. And I think... At the conversation, we quite often talk about the people are drowning in information, which is otherwise known as infomania. There's just so much of it. And the question is, well, which are the trusted sources? Now, there'll be a new information order which will start evolving. You can see an example of that already with Google News. So Google News, to actually be approved by them, in other words, for them to load you up, they give you four or five rules you have to tick the boxes on. Now, we had to go through that process, and then we got an email, it's like winning the pools, that said, congratulations, you've been accepted by Google News. Now, what does that involve? It involves, one, that you have to, as part of Google News, cover what's current. Two, you have to have a system, a clearly articulated system of controls. Three, you have to have editors. Four, you have to have multiple authors, so it can't just be a blogger, one person. Five, you have to have a URL that they accept, and because we're an EDU, we go further up. So there's a whole bunch of protocols as well which will go around that, and I think these will evolve in time into sort of, and I'm just talking here about news rather than, you know, entertainment or whatever else, but you will come up with a new information order where you'll have some sites will be, as it were, triple rated, or others, you know, two stars, and others one, and others will be, you know, well, these are hopeless, but if you want to go to them, you can anyway. As I say, it's so fluid, it's so fast moving, I find it really exciting, but, you know, getting onto the Google News thing just meant that our content now is distributed much more widely across the world, so 40% of our traffic comes now from elsewhere. So these are the kind of new protocols which are evolving, and part of it comes back to what I said right at the beginning, that we want to be right at the very beginning trying to provide for our readers transparency around who our authors are, what their levels of expertise are, who's funding them, and so on and so forth, because we don't want this service to go down the route of becoming something which is just seen as pushing a certain ideological or commercial perspective.
I'm going to have to jump in there and just get a final comment if you'd like, Sandra.
Okay.
We won't have time. Sorry, we won't
based
have time
on those,
for
a, no.
Good question. I come from a media background in business press with international publishers, etc. I'm just here to congratulate the Adelaide Review on being game, in a way, to start another publication, because I know what's involved in launching it. Well done.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That's
well, I'm glad we allowed that.
Yeah, indeed. I was about to cut that off. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to wrap up by saying, you know, Andrew just talking about, you know, all this huge amount of information that's out there, and where's the quality? I mean, I'd like to think that the ABC has a brand. In fact, I know from news polling that we have a very strong brand, that's hard earned, and it needs to be, you know, we need to every day keep that quality up. But it is about providing that quality. I mean, Sky News, for instance, their slogan won't be wrong for long. and that's, you know, that's a strength there for them, obviously. But we are very, you know, we take it very seriously that we check all those sources, and we make sure that when you hear it on the ABC that it's accurate. Having said that, you know, there's humans at the ABC as well as everywhere else, and you know, we're not perfect. But I do think it is about the charter, and it is about the brand, and with the, whether it's online, whatever platform it is, and obviously we are going online more and more, and we have to be there. But in this huge amount of noise, I do think trusted brands, whether newspapers or whether the broadcasters like the ABC, which are going into other areas, you know, it's vitally important that we maintain those same standards. And of course, a convergence review, which I won't get into now, but that's happening at the moment, and that's looking at the Broadcasting Services Act and a whole range of other acts, Copyright Act, which, you know, all written for the analogue era. But now, of course, we are in a very different era, and a lot of these things just don't make sense anymore in terms of the regulations that we're currently under. So
I think events in the UK this year certainly show that you live and die by your integrity. So, and I think that's something that's come through very strongly in what you've all said. Look, would you please join me in thanking our panellists, Andrew and Sandra, and thank you very much for coming along.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.